Of all the experiences a human has, perhaps the most intimate is that of their own consciousness. Not conscience, as in that inner directive allowing us to discern right from wrong, but consciousness, as in my second-by-second awareness of myself and my surroundings while awake. This phenomenon is so close to us, so constantly with us, that for the most part, it goes unnoted during our day-to-day lives. Rather, we think our thoughts and do what we do without much consideration of where those thoughts and impulses come from. Our consciousness, in this sense, is a constant inner companion, integral to our being human. And each of us seems to have our very own consciousness, to a large degree unshareable with others. Yes, other people can see us smile and hear us talk, and in that sense, they can discern much about our inner state of being. But our actual moment-by-moment experience of life is ours alone, unexperienceable by others. And it is this facet of consciousness, the fundamental inability of others to experience a phenomenon that we ourselves are able to experience, that differentiates it from just about every other phenomenon known to humanity. Beyond the above qualitative descriptions, what do I mean by the word consciousness? Under the listing for consciousness, Merriam-Webster's dictionary has, among others, the entries, the quality or state of being aware, especially of something within oneself, and the state of being characterized by sensation, emotion, volition, and thought. As a phenomenon, consciousness exhibits many facets, including but not limited to memory, sensual experiences such as sight and hearing, cognition, intent, and emotions. I'm sure if we gave it more thought, we could add even more to that list. My favorite definition, however, is that given as a response to claims of a completely mechanized view of the human body as consciousness is the ghost in the machine. I hope in the course of this sermon to convince you that whatever consciousness is, its intimacy and apparent mundaneness hides an astonishing quixotic nature that resists attempts to comprehensively define and explain it. It ends up humans have been thinking about consciousness from time immemorial. There is evidence that all major ancient civilizations had people theorizing about the nature of consciousness, including attempts to define it. Fascinating and informing as those efforts are, I don't have time to describe them here. Rather, we will limit our discussion to modern theories, especially those amenable to the scientific method. The first theory we will examine is rather philosophical and was developed by Indiana University cognitive philosopher Douglas Hofstadter in his seminal book, Gödel-Escherbach. Hofstadter noted that as a phenomenon, consciousness shares features with other phenomena as disparate as mathematical proof theory, the classical music of composer Johann Sebastian Bach, and the art of artist M.C. Escher. The primary feature he highlighted was that each of these various other phenomena contained self-referential structures. Hofstadter maintained that consciousness also has that same self-referential feature in the sense of when we observe our own conscious states, that in itself is a conscious state. Hofstadter referred to these self-referential structures as strange loops and made his formulation of consciousness explicit in another book titled I Am a Strange Loop. So just to kind of digress a bit, what Hofstadter is saying essentially boils down to is that consciousness is a type of phenomena that contains itself. It's kind of weird that way, that it's aware of its own self in a way. There is an associated school of thought regarding consciousness called the functional school. The functional school maintains that consciousness is a function of the logical relations within a network structure, and any network exhibiting these relational structures will also exhibit consciousness. In this formulation, the interconnected neurons of the brain are simply one substrate of that logical network structure necessary for consciousness. And let me digress quickly here again. So, and I'll put my glasses on for this. So the human brain is composed of things called cells called neurons. And what neurons have is, if my shoulder here would be considered a cell nucleus, each neuron cell has dendrites that come out of it, and the one neuron has one dendrite that comes out, and it has a bulb at the end of it that will release neurotransmitters. These neurotransmitters connect with receptor sites in kind of the dendrite from the other neuron sort of meeting close to it. And then an electrochemical impulse will go up that one to the other nerve, the other neuron nuclei. And so that's what your brain is. It's just, it has billions of these connections like that. So it's a very, very dense network is basically what your brain is. And it's constantly giving out electrochemical impulses that travel all over. So let me just say this again. In this formulation, the interconnected neurons of the brain are simply one substrate of that logical network structure necessary for consciousness. However, it is by no means the only one. So the functional school maintains that if networks such as the internet or power grids, for example, ever exhibit the same self-referential logical network as the human brain did, they would also be conscious. Though this is a radical idea indeed, the next model of consciousness we will examine has not only incorporated it into a more specific theory, but even has empirically tested predictive scientific evidence in support of it. Integrated information theory was developed by Giulio Tononi of the University of Wisconsin and Marcello Massimini of the University of Milan. IIT, as it's known, takes Hofstadter's strange loop idea and looks for evidence of it within the neurologic network structure of the human brain. Wonder of wonders, it actually finds it, of a sort that is. What it finds is that if you model the human brain as what is known mathematically as a network-directed graph, there are network structures within it that form feedback loops. These feedback loops within the network structure have demonstrable cause and effect features. In this sense, they share both Hofstadter's self-referential strange loop formulation, as well as the functional school's logical relationship formulation. Tononi and Massimini went on to make numeric predictions as to how the rest of the human brain would respond electrochemically to electromagnetic perturbations while under various states of anesthesia. To test this, they had over 100 people, which is, that's a statistically significant set. So the conclusions they were able to draw from this are very strong. They had over 100 people volunteer to undergo medically induced states of anesthesia. These states intentionally varied, with some producing very mild semi-conscious states and others producing very deep states of complete unconsciousness. While in that state, they administered an electromagnetic perturbation to the brain and measured the electrochemical response. They compared these responses with what their theory predicted would occur and achieved dramatic results. By and large, their predictions of the response dynamics were upheld. They then went on to administer the same perturbations to other people currently hospitalized in states of neurologic vegetation. So they were in what are called vegetative states. To their surprise, they found 12 such individuals that by their measurements were actually conscious, just simply unable to respond to normal neurologic stimulus. These experimental results, showing an empirically verifiable relationship between logical network structure and states of consciousness lend great credence to claims that something such as the internet, a power grid, or a neural network computer program could actually exhibit consciousness. We have so far accepted the premise that consciousness is a product of the neurologic activity of the brain uncritically. And where I'm going at here is IIT, as I've just described it, has very strong scientific support of it, but it is by no means the only theory, and we're going to get into a few others here. And the other theories are a bit different. So that's kind of where I'm navigating now. That is indeed the case, that is to say that consciousness is a product of the brain and its neurologic activity. That is indeed the case might seem obvious in the extreme. Each of us gets tired and sleeps at night. During that time, our experience is very different from conscious states. Associated with that state of sleep are verifiable changes in neurologic dynamics. Almost all of us have imbibed intoxicants and have experienced a corresponding change in conscious experience. It is verifiable that inducing chemical changes into the brain likewise induces changes in conscious experience. We have suffered blows to the head that induced us to see stars and have known people to suffer even worse damage to their brain. In most cases, there was at least a temporary change in conscious experience, not only reported by the unfortunate, but visibly evident in their speech and activities. And the evidence in support of that claim is even stronger scientifically than our own colloquial experiences. When a portion of the brain known as the posterior cortex is stimulated or damaged, patients reported associated changes in conscious experience. No other portion of the brain exhibits this. Furthermore, those network cause and effect feedback loops discovered by the integrated information theory of consciousness occur in exactly that portion of the human brain, the posterior cortex. This is strong evidence indeed that consciousness is a product of the brain. How then, you may ask, is it conceivable that consciousness can be anything but a product of the brain? Let me give you some arguments that weaken that assumption. To start, there are aspects of human thinking that reside elsewhere and are even a product of things outside the brain. Diaries, journals, and photos are a form of non-neurologic memory. Likewise, calculators are a form of non-neurologic cognitive activity. If you consider it, there are probably quite a few other examples of this type of non-neurologic activity we associate with consciousness. You may retort, yes, but they are in origin a product of neurology. The effect is simply one of delay. And you are to some degree correct. Nevertheless, the detour in that delay is outside the bounds of the brain and hence non-neurologic. In any case, surely we can agree that these non-neurologic examples of activity we associate with consciousness alter our conscious experience. This weakens the claim that consciousness is a product of the brain alone. As well, there are examples of human organs that are more reactive than they are productive. What I mean by this is that whereas blood circulation is produced by the heart and arteries, the sensation of touch is not produced by the skin. The skin is only reactive when it comes into contact with external stimulation. Absent hallucination, the skin never produces sensation on its own. The question of whether consciousness is a product of the brain is essentially a question of, as an organ, how much is the brain like the heart and how much is it like the skin? As we discussed earlier, integrated information theory holds that consciousness is a product of the neuron interconnectivity located in the posterior cortex. As such, it claims the brain is more like the heart than like skin, actually producing consciousness. Our final theory of consciousness, however, answers the question to the contrary. Orchestrated objective reduction was formulated by Nobel Prize-winning physicist Roger Penrose and neurologist Stuart Hameroff. OOR, as it's known, posits that conscious states originate within neuron cell nuclei in a quantum mechanical fashion, with neuron interconnectivity playing only a supportive role. So I'm going to give this visual again. So in IIT, it's the dynamics of the connectivity that is producing consciousness. In orchestrated objective reduction, they're saying that there are quantum mechanical things happening in the nuclei, and that is what is going on. And that is still happening within the brain, but this theory is going to claim that the brain is more reacting to external things, including our own thoughts and memories, than it is causing them. So let me say that OOR, as it's known, posits that conscious states originate within neuron cell nuclei in a quantum mechanical fashion, with neuron interconnectivity playing only a supportive role. This differentiates it fundamentally from integrated information theory, which holds that the network portion of neuron interconnectivity produces conscious states. And this is the key sentence right here. In orchestrated objective reduction, changes in conscious states are a product of quantum entanglement with external physical reality. In this fashion, when external physical reality changes, our conscious states change likewise as a result of that quantum entanglement. This may sound far-fetched, but Hameroff identifies in support of it protein areas within the neuron nuclei containing microtubules. These microtubules are of a dimension corresponding to that level associated with quantum mechanics. Early naysayers responded with then-accurate claims that quantum entanglement at the scale necessary for conscious awareness would decompose too quickly for any coherent thought to be maintained. However, experiments in recent years have shown the opposite, that in fact larger-scale entanglements can be maintained for very long time periods and at physical distances measuring in the hundreds of thousands of miles. Penrose wrote a book describing how this theory of consciousness could work, titled The Emperor's New Mind. So at this point, I would note that the orchestrated objective reduction theory of consciousness posits the brain as more like skin than the heart, claiming that changes in consciousness result from changes in quantum states entangled with external physical reality, is akin to claiming the brain is more of an antenna than simply an engine producing acceleration. In that regard, it's more reactive, like skin, than productive, like the heart. OOR is a seriously considered explanation of consciousness along with a physical explanation. If it is so considered, then we must admit that non-neurologic explanations for the origin of consciousness have at least an established toehold as legitimate. Let me further weaken the assumption that consciousness is a product of the brain with another analogy. Consider your relationship with your house, with that of consciousness and your brain. If you consider it, there are striking similarities. Much of what we know of the human brain, we know from measuring the dynamics of neurologic activity. Electromagnetic impulses and metabolite consumption in differing brain areas during specific tasks are examples of such measurements. This is akin, however, to measuring the activity of my house by measuring it externally with a very sensitive infrared sensor. And like my brain, my house exhibits predictable patterns. There is little activity restricted to my bedroom from about 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. From 6 a.m. to 6:30, that activity increases and is limited mostly to my bathroom. Following that, it increases in my kitchen and living room. Like my brain, my house exhibits activity in various parts during specific times, yet in no way am I a product of my house. I simply reside there. But how does this analogy explain the changes we see in people resulting from brain trauma? When the roof of my house is damaged and leaky, I likewise change my activity within the house, and measurement would show that. When my furnace or air conditioning is damaged, I likewise alter the activity in my house. Yet still, I am in no way a product of my house. I simply reside there, having changed my behavior in response to the damage to my house. If, as orchestrated objective reduction holds, the brain is more like an antenna, when the antenna is damaged, conscious experience changes likewise. The antenna, however, still doesn't produce anything. It simply registers a signal from an external source. I hope the conclusion I am drawing regarding consciousness and the brain is now obvious. It may be that consciousness isn't a product of the brain at all, but rather certain network structures or computational state dynamics induce a consciousness that originates elsewhere, simply residing in those networks for the time while they are active. What then about consciousness and the scientific method? At the start of this sermon, I pointed out how profoundly intimate consciousness is as a phenomenon. Our constant companion, it remains so close to us, no one but ourselves can experience it. That feature, at least then, is fundamentally unobservable to the rest of humanity. The scientific method, however, is predicated upon gathering and observing evidence upon which to formulate and test theories. And that evidence must be observable to everyone with the normal capacity to observe. As only I can observe my experience of consciousness, and likewise, only you can observe yours, how then can that feature, at least, of consciousness be amenable to the scientific method? Other features, such as our expressions and actions as evidence of our state of mind, are indeed surely observable and hence open to the scientific method. The activity of neurons is observable, surely observable. You know, there's lots about it that is surely observable. But I maintain these phenomena differ fundamentally from our moment-by-moment experiences of our own consciousness, observable only by each of us and no one else. Suppose even further that consciousness is a product of neurology, and we actually had a way of not only knowing that state of another person's neuron, we could translate that state into our own. Wouldn't that be experiencing what they are and hence observing their consciousness? No, it would not. In similar fashion as to both you and I reading the same book, our experience of reading it would each be our own. Likewise, anyone else experiencing a facsimile of my consciousness would be their experience of it. It wouldn't be my experience of it. And I don't mean merely a difference in qualitative detail. I mean, in a fundamental sense, only I can experience what I experience. Likewise, no one else can experience what anyone else experiences. In this sense, I claim at least that feature of consciousness, that of our own experience of it, to be beyond the scientific method, predicated as it is upon shareable observation. Ghost in the machine, indeed. To conclude, my intent with this sermon was to pique everyone's interest regarding consciousness, something so close to us, so ever-present during our waking hours that it goes unexamined for the most part. I hope I have achieved that end. To me, consciousness is a fascinating subject that tests the limits of the scientific method even while remaining, for the most part, open to advances in our understanding. That understanding incorporates subjects as diverse as mathematics, physiology, physics, chemistry, and even philosophy. It even questions what it means to be a sentient thing. and that at least one aspect of it appears to be beyond the scope of the scientific method, I find to be very refreshing. I like the idea of living in an ultimately open-ended universe, even if only in a small but beautifully intimate way. I hope you do too.